Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins on the local news roundup. Hugh Hadabaugh is back in charge at CMS again as interim superintendent, but his eye is on making changes. Meanwhile, the school board okays a $2.1 billion budget to send to Mecklenburg County Commission for approval. We'll talk about the prospects for that. As early voting gets underway, Congressman Madison Cawthorn is making headlines by trying to take another loaded gun on an airplane, while North Carolina Republican Senator Tom Tillis suggests Cawthorn be investigated for insider trading. Panthers owner David Tepper speaks about what happened in Rock Hill while not saying much. He does have nice things to say about Charlotte. And before the case can go to trial, McCray Dallas, the man at the center of the 9th District election fraud scandal, dies. To help us through all those stories and more is a bevy of local TV reporters. Please, no wagering on who gets the last word here today. Jonathan Lowe is here. He's reporter anchor for Spectrum News 1. Good morning, Jonathan.
Good morning, Mike. Good to see you.
Seema Iyer is back with us. She is the chief legal correspondent for WJZY's Queen City News. Good morning, Seema.
Good morning, everybody.
Joe Bruno is our judge today. He is sitting in the conference room at WSOC-TV, Channel 9. Very nice wood paneling behind you. They make a lot of money over there, don't they? Good morning. Welcome.
Will the defendant please rise? Okay. If you're about to introduce him.
And here's the defendant, Nick Oxner, WBTV's chief investigative reporter and co-author of The Vote Collectors, which is about the 9th District electoral fraud scandal. But welcome back.
May it please the court, Your Honor.
Yes. As we all know, after firing Ernest Winston, the CMS school board offered former interim superintendent that job again, Hugh Hadabaugh, and he said yes. He started the job this past Monday, and it appears he is ready to hit the ground running. Just a week in, he told the school board he is making some changes.
One of the first questions I asked the board chair and general counsel when called regarding the interim superintendent position was, will I have authority to recommend changes in key personnel that affect student outcomes? The answer was yes.
So, what changes does he have in mind?
Joe. Sounds like he wants to restructure some of the academic staff, create more learning communities. Definitely got a no-nonsense vibe from him. Someone who wants to hit the ground running immediately. He said there isn't going to be a 100-day listening tour. He came in here to do something and he's going to do it.
Well, does he need to do the learning and listening tour? He's done this job before. Prior to being the temporary superintendent, he was also in administration at CMS for years. He taught. I think he stuck around and lived in Charlotte during the time he was not superintendent. Does he really? He knows what's going on, right?
Conceivably, yeah. I think that's why they went back to the well. Someone in CMS before he was officially coronated last week described him as an old high school girlfriend that you're falling back in love with.
Great. And he told the board that he is ready to, quote, break the gridlock. What did he mean by that?
Well, one of the knocks on Ernest Winston, and frankly, one of the reasons he was fired, is because there was not a lot happening in the district. Board members wanted to see results. In December, we've reported he got a list of 5 action items that he needed to accomplish by the end of the first semester. 2 of those things involved presenting and starting to implement a plan for student achievement by the end of the first semester, and presenting and starting to implement a safety plan. Both of those things, academic achievement and campus safety, are things the district struggled with. While arguably he presented a thing, it didn't satisfy board members and they didn't see any real action. And so it's very real to say, and certainly Hugh Hadabaugh has recognized and spoken to the fact that he understands the school board wants action from its top leaders. He has said today or this week in his comments after the board meeting to reporters that there are very capable staff. They just needed a top leader to come in and say yes and no and give them direction. I think that's what he intends to do. Hmm.
He also said that there were very few districts in the country, and he's worked at a few, that he would ever entertain joining, and Charlotte is one. He said that he was, quote, thrilled to get the opportunity to come back, and he called the opportunity return a privilege. Given all that's happened over the last several years, and given the declining reputation in some people's minds of our school system, what message does that send? He's privileged to be here.
One of my questions to him was, why do you want to do this? Are you sure you want to do this? Florida is great. Why do you want to leave and come back here for a year? And he said that his dad is 98 years old and he takes care of him. And he was thinking about how he wanted to spend the next 25, 27 years of his life. And he thought it would be very rewarding to return to a school district like Charlotte-Mecklenburg that means so much to him and try to make an impact. So he seems very up for this challenge.
So I was wrong. He did not stick around between the time, the interim period between the first time he was superintendent and today. He's been out.
No, he went down to Florida and then later retired down there, Orange County, I believe.
And he loves us so much, he's leaving the beach.
Yeah, he said all that during his first public appearance since returning to the job, and he told the board what it already knew about a plan that they laid out for moving forward, but it was an opportunity for parents and teachers and students and staff to hear about this plan that is aimed at focusing on the district's most urgent needs.
The intent of the model is to ensure essential resources are driven rapidly to the students and schools in greatest need to decrease the achievement gap for our minority students and students in poverty.
Did he explain that and how it would work in greater detail or even give a date as to when this plan might be rolled out, Joe?
No, not really. I think we're expecting more information, though, in May. You can just kind of tell by the way he speaks, like a lot of educational jargon, that he's just in this to, you know, accomplish this task and move on. Like there isn't a whole lot of fluff in his statements. He's focused on this goal of increasing student achievement and outcomes. Another question that got asked to him was about school safety and what his plan is to make the school safer, especially as so many weapons have been discovered. A BB gun was discovered at Independence yesterday. And he's trusting a lot that the students will settle in after 2 years of disruption, and he is continuing down a path that Ernest Winston laid out with some of the things that he's proposed.
Yeah, when it comes to safety, he said that the most important thing is having, quote, trusted adults at each school visible during critical times of the day, meaning, I guess, at arrival and departure and when they change classes at the high school and, I guess, junior high school level. If not teachers and staff, who are these trusted adults supposed to be?
Well, I don't know if one thing that happened with under Ernest Winston was we saw like Hopewell High School bring in parents to the hallways. And that's been a model of success in other school districts across the country. Perhaps that's what he's referring to. I think the bulk of what he was talking about, though, having teachers present, people that the students trust, that they can discreetly tell if they see something is going wrong.
He also said that the district needs to focus on retaining and recruiting teachers, and that it would be nearly impossible to close the achievement gap, which we've been talking about here for months at CMS, with the system down by 500 to 600 teachers. Wow. How does he plan to address that? Because there's more to that than just CMS. It's happening everywhere.
It's a real problem. I think our next topic item is of discussion is going to be the way increasing teacher pay, which is included in the budget, is a way that CMS is trying to staunch the bleeding. Obviously, there's a systemic problem with teacher burnout, with stemming from COVID and job demands and low pay. And CMS took a big step this week towards trying to at least address a part of the problem.
And at this press conference, following the board meeting, Hadabaugh told the press that he recognizes that communication has been a problem, and he is advertising for a communications chief with experience in large urban districts. Since you all talk to people in the public eye, what has been, from your perspective, and I'll start with Nick because he's the sunshine guy, what has been your problem with communications, particularly at CMS?
Well, everything in a nutshell. I mean, and And look at, go back to the summary of the investigation that was done into Ernest Winston that was released by the school board last week. Keep in mind, we're talking about a guy who became superintendent with no advanced degree and no specialized education training by working his way through the CMS communication apparatus, who had as his chief of staff a woman who very recently, who her job was to head the communications office. And one of the biggest knocks on Winston in this summary that was released last week by this outside attorney from both the board and from staff was that they didn't know how to communicate and they weren't effectively communicating. It was nearly impossible to get answers back in a timely fashion from the communications office. It is still impossible. In fact, I have inquiries that have gone on for weeks without getting a response back from the woman currently heading the CMS communications office. Eve, if you're listening, I would still like the answer to my inquiry from yesterday that ran last night. And that's just part of the problem. You also have a district that is just incapable of complying with the Public Records Act and the Open Meetings Act, both of which are issues I have pending lawsuits against them on. But that's not actually the purview of the communications office. That's centered in the general counsel's office, reports separately to the school board. And I was told multiple times in the last year that I've been investigating CMS that the communications office only spoke for the superintendent and central office, but didn't speak for the general counsel, didn't speak for the school board, and didn't speak for school principals. So who exactly do you speak for? And so you have a decentralized communications apparatus. You have people fulfilling records or not fulfilling records that are separate from your communications shop. And it is a mess trying to get anything out of CMS.
And Seema, as Nick has reported many times this year with regard to the sexual assault allegations at several schools and other aspects of CMS, they closely guard personnel records. And I know there are legal aspects to that. And as the attorney on this panel, I'm just curious how much of that is trumped up, how much of that is actual? Because these people that they're hiring and firing and decisions they are making are all being made by people that we as taxpayers pay. So don't we have a right to know more than we know?
Yes, I think a lot of it is bull, honestly. I think if you as an organization, a news organization, or any other party that has a standing, a legal standing to see those records, your best course of action is to make a motion to the court, because what the court can do is look at these records in camera. So that means in chambers, right? So the judge looks at the records and decides, yes, this is privileged. I'm not going to show this, but no, this part is not privileged and should be turned over to the opposing party, because the public does have a right to know. These are, like you're saying, the personnel who are in charge of the community's children. Right. But the best way to address that, instead of attorneys going back and forth, is always take it to the court to look at it in camera.
Joe, did you want to chime in?
Yeah, just going back to the communications chief that Hattaball wants to hire. One thing that's going to be challenging is, because of state law, no contract can be provided to one of these leaders that's longer than the superintendent's. So he's wanting a chief communications officer who has experience in a large school district, who is going to kind of have to take a chance on CMS because their contract will only last until June 2023. So there's a lot going on there. Think about it. You have to move possibly across the country, you know, take a chance on the school district that's incredibly on fire right now and hope that you can make a difference in that short amount of time and get an extended contract. You didn't just do all this for nothing.
A big opportunity for someone who specializes in crisis communications, one may
say. All right, we have to take a break. We have a little bit more to talk about with regard to CMS and then, of course, their budget. Madison Cawthorn in the headlines again. Oh, so much fun. And McCrae Dallas, who passed away prior to even having a chance to defend himself in a trial down east. We'll talk about that and more when we come back. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's the Charlotte Talks Local News Roundup on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE. We're here with four television people My goodness. And they all look great. All have their makeup on and everything. Joe Bruno is here from WSSC-TV Channel 9. He doesn't wear makeup. Nick Oxner, true, he doesn't either. Chief investigative reporter for WBTV is here. Jonathan Lowe, I can't speak for Jonathan. He's a reporter anchor for Spectrum News 1 and Seema Ayers, chief legal correspondent for WJZY Queen City News. As we know, former Superintendent Ernest Winston bought and then shelved about 46,000 clear backpacks after it was discovered that they had cancer warning labels on them required by the state of California. These bags cost the system hundreds of thousands of dollars. What did Hugh Hattabaugh say about the disposition of those bags? Anybody?
Well, basically, for now, they are having serious discussions on what's going to happen to them, but they're going to stay on hold for the time being.
And Seema, I'm coming back to you as the attorney here, because there are cancer warning labels on lots of products that we as consumers buy every day. And they are there because they're sold not only here in North Carolina, but they're sold in the state of California, which has a requirement that these labels be put on if they contain anything that ever has any possibility to touch cancer. And yesterday, I received a delivery that had a plastic bag surrounding it. And all plastic bags, even the dry cleaning plastic bags, have these warnings about suffocation and keeping them away from children. We look at them, that's supposed to remind us to do the right thing with those things.
Right.
But then we move on with our lives.
Yeah.
What about these cancer warnings? Are they there because of liability issues? Are they concerned about it here because of liability issues? And if so, what other things that have to go with children to school have liability issues that we simply ignore?
Well, children itself are a liability, right? They're like a walking, talking accident illness. But I remember Joe saying this last time, like even shower curtains, right, have these same warning labels. And yes, it does go under products liability. So whoever creates that product has a duty to the consumer to warn them.
But we're sending out kids with computers that have Bluetooth and Wi-Fi. And are there not concerns about health
radioactivity
hazards?
Yes.
So
yes.
What about those?
They're all a concern, but as long as there is some type of generalized protection, meaning this is not likely to cause cancer or other illness with a normal amount of exposure. Under the law, we use this term reasonable. So what is a reasonable amount of exposure is perhaps a child being in front of the computer 8 hours a day or even 10 hours a day. That will not cause illness. In order to be liable in such case, phone, computer, you would have to have over that amount of exposure, something that the creator of that product could not reasonably foresee. So it has to be reasonably foreseeable for whoever creates that product.
So in your legal mind, they are acting responsibly. The caution with which they are acting is responsible.
To put the labels on the backpacks? Yes.
Well, and also to hold those backpacks in storage until they figure out what to do with them.
They shouldn't have bought the backpacks. I don't understand why they even bought the backpacks to begin with. Because when you listen, if you look on Amazon, even when you're buying a product, right, you can see the warnings before purchasing. So it was the school's fault for even purchasing these and keeping them in storage. But yes, they are doing the right thing. However, I think more evidence needs to show how much exposure the children would be in and how much danger they would be in of actual illness.
Okay. So as the school board pays out the contract of the departed Ernest Winston to the tune of a lot of money, hundreds of thousands of dollars, and adds Hugh Hattabaugh's salary to its ledger, they just voted unanimously to pass a $2.1 billion budget for next year. $578.4 million of that is slated to come from the Mecklenburg County Commission. That's an increase of more than $40 million over the current year. Jonathan, why the increase?
So I think the biggest part of this, as Nick mentioned earlier, is the 10% pay increase on top of their supplement for teachers and certified staff. And then I think part-timers would get like $16.50 an hour minimum of. That's the biggest part of that $578 million is trying to increase teacher pay, which is always a major topic. But also some of the other things that they are looking at doing, like hiring more emotional support staff for students, and trying to increase their staffing for staff who can help students with their closing the achievement gap. So I think that takes up the largest part of that $578 million that they're asked, or $2.1 billion actually.
If these teacher pay raises go through, it will make Charlotte-Mecklenburg teachers the highest paid in the state. And in a news release, School Board Chair Elise Dashew said that, quote, for too long, governing bodies have argued about budgets as if they are only numbers on a page. But a thoughtful budget is more than that. Each member represents our assessment, or each number represents our assessment of the needs of our students and how best to meet those needs. We've been told for years that education here in the state is underfunded, that teachers are underpaid. We know that the state did for a while cut education funding, I think, and only recently began to increase salaries. Will that statement successfully counter any argument that money is not the solution to our problems in education?
It's, look, when you have staff leaving in droves, like we just talked about a few minutes ago, a solution to that is at least keeping the staff you have with salary increases. You know, a 10% increase in the local teaching supplement, which, by the way, as its name suggests, is just a supplement with local dollars to the state pay that you get in Mecklenburg County. While it's going to put CMS at the top pay in the state, while it's significantly more than what Union County pays its first year teachers, is only going to go so far. It would bring the starting salary up to somewhere just above $42,000, which again, when you look at the range of jobs that someone might take leaving college in today's pay market, I still don't know that you're going to get, you know, the top talent unless those folks are really dedicated to teaching, in which case, God bless you. But, you know, it certainly is a factor. And I think the, you know, recent job market upheaval has forced people to go back and relook and say, yes, both in schools and everywhere else, yes, we do actually have to pay our talent. And that is a major factor.
And this budget also includes $32 million in temporary COVID-related money that came from the federal government. How long will that last? How do they intend to use it? And when they use it and the money runs dry, what then?
Well, I think that's more like gravy on top, that money that you didn't really think that you would have or know that you would have. And now that you have it, you can do more. And I think with stimulus dollars, people have to kind of look at that at not as far as how long do they have to use it. It's more so, I believe with stimulus dollars, they have the first stimulus was like 20, it has to be spent by 2023. And then the second stimulus was like 2026. So, you know, the federal government gave municipalities, school governments, I believe, enough time to figure out how they can best use those stimulus dollars. It's been it's something that has played out with city council and the Mecklenburg County Commission for months.
So this budget request now goes to the county commission. There is no love lost between those two bodies, and we'll talk about more about that as that budget proceeds through commission in the coming weeks. We will all be late voting in the primaries because the primaries were delayed by almost a year because of COVID, but now early voting for those primaries is underway. How many places are open for early voting? Do they differ in terms of number or location or days of the week in which early voting has traditionally taken place in previous elections, Joe?
16 places are open. There are in all parts of Mecklenburg County. So if you are, no matter where you live, you'll find somewhere that's close. So what's great about early voting is you don't have to go to an assigned precinct. So if you're in Uptown one day and you feel like rolling over to the Hal Marshall Annex, you can vote there, but you can also just go to the Eastway Rec Center, South Park Library, wherever you want to vote, you can. This is also the time where if you aren't registered to vote or if you have to update your registration, go to an early voting site. They can take care of you there. Only about 1,400 people voted countywide on the first day of early voting, so you're not going to have to wait in a long line.
Put this election into perspective. This is a primary. And there are lots of people running for various different offices, from city council to mayor to house districts and others. If you don't participate, are you being foolish as a citizen?
Yes. Because first of all, let's talk about Republican wise. We got a very high profile Senate race with Ted Budd, Pat McCrory, and Mark Walker. That's a reason to vote if you're a Republican. If you're a Democrat, you're going to decide who the sheriff is, who the district attorney is in this primary as well, because there are no Republican challengers. You also have mayoral at large for county and city races, competitive races all up and down the ballot. And if you're unaffiliated, you could choose which one you want to participate in. So there really is something for everyone in this election.
Yeah, for newcomers to North Carolina, you can vote. You can choose to vote in whichever primary you wish to participate in, particularly if you're independent. And I guess you can change your party affiliation if you're a Democrat or a Republican and you want to vote in the other party's primary. The actual primary will be May 17th. Is this a situation in which the candidate choices will be decided in that primary, as opposed to the general election in November? Jonathan?
Some, like the sheriff, district attorney, District 2, Mecklenburg County Commission. Those are a couple races. District 1, Charlotte City Council.
Jonathan, did you want to chime in on that? I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to echo that. I think it just depends on the race.
So it behooves you to vote in the primary, which the last day of which is the actual date, May 17th. One of the hot congressional races in North Carolina is the state's 11th district. Madison Cawthorn is the incumbent there. In recent days, he's made some controversial statements. The House Majority Leader slapped his hand for one that he made about being invited to an orgy where drugs were being consumed with fellow members of Congress. Evidently, that turned out not to be true, or at least that's what's being said after Kevin McCarthy slapped him down. And now he's been cited again, Madison Cawthorn, trying to take a loaded gun onto an airplane, and not for the first time. What happened?
Joe. He was moving his way through security checkpoint D, left his handgun in his bag. It got flagged by TSA. And he was cited by CMPD.
Yeah, the gun was discovered here at our airport, Charlotte Douglas. Yeah. On Wednesday, Cawthorn posted a written message on Instagram advising us to, quote, take an extra 30 to 60 seconds to check your bags and make sure everything is as it should be. And he also posted a video. This being radio, we can only play the audio, but here it is.
So flying home from D.C. back home to Western North Carolina. Early voting starts tomorrow. Super excited about it. But really good news. Just went through TSA. No major alarms. Nothing bad happened. So to all the law enforcement out there, especially you guys at Charlotte, I love you all. Appreciate you guys. You all keep us safe. Seriously. Thanks. Fly safe. Make sure you don't have a gun in your bag.
Is he being sincere or just a jerk frat boy?
Jerk?
That's a good frat question. Boy? Because, you know, this is the second time this happened. I don't know if you mentioned it yet, but I mean, he did the same thing in Asheville's airport. And you would think that someone of that at that level would be, you know, clear on the laws and also know what's in their bag before they go through security. I mean, I'm not a congressman, but I certainly know what's in my carry on while I'm going through security.
Yeah. Seema.
I think the problem is he may be clear about the laws because he is relying, I think, on one article of the Constitution where it basically says that he can't get privilege from arrest. But it also says during their attendance at the session, not on your way to the session. I don't know if they knew that at the airport.
Yeah.
There is an exception for felonies, and the airport citation by the CMPD is a misdemeanor. So he got out of this in a variety of different ways.
Well, he keeps doing this, as we've said. This is the second time with a gun at an airport. He also
grabbed... it's loaded, which is the worst part.
He also grabbed headlines in recent weeks about having three speeding tickets and driving on expired tags for which his driver's license was confiscated. He took knives into places that don't allow them, like school board meetings. How do we explain this behavior, and why hasn't, I don't know, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, this would have ditched his career forever. Why does this just get washed over?
I can, okay, you guys, somebody else can talk about explaining his behavior and I'll talk about how to get rid of him. Well, who wants to go?
Well, it, look, there's so much, there's such a flood of headlines about Madison Cawthorn. I mean, we're talking about guns, we're talking about speeding tickets. Meanwhile, in DC, there are articles about possible insider trading violations. Meanwhile, there are other tabloid headlines floating around about him in the last week. So it's hard to focus on any one thing, but also what that does, and specifically in terms of his primary campaign right now, is he's a guy that is infamous, known for better or worse, across the country and certainly across the 11th Congressional District, running against a smorgasbord of opposition. And so it,
in his own
all
party.
He needs is, yes, absolutely. But all he needs is 30% plus one of the vote in the primary to clear, and then he wins.
Joe.
Yeah, and I'm curious. I mean, there's a lot of D.C. press, but are the people sitting at the bar at Balsam Falls Brewing in Silva, North Carolina, caring right now about the flood of headlines? Right. What Nick Oxner says is absolutely right. 30% is all he needs to get through the primary and on to the general election, where he will be heavily favored.
And as one of you mentioned this week, it was Republican North Carolina Senator Tom Tillis who suggested that Cawthorn be investigated for insider trading. Why?
It comes to how, where do we begin? It all involves a Let's Go Brandon cryptocurrency,
a pump and dump scheme, right?
It surrounds parties that he attended and posts he made on social media. A comment that he made saying, "Let's go to the moon," which is referring to when a cryptocurrency takes off, like the stock market. And he made a post. This is so inside baseball and stuff I just never imagined explaining ever in my life. But basically, a deal was announced with this race car driver that the Let's Go Brandon coin would be a primary sponsor, and the meme cryptocurrency did go to the moon. It's spiked up, and then eventually it crashed.
And then it fell. And Cawthorn put this explanation on Instagram.
We're starting to see this coordinated drip campaign. When I say a drip campaign, it's where they're going to drop an attack article every 1 or 2 days just to try and kill us with a death by 1,000 cuts. And that is really their main strategy.
So we'll come back and we'll talk about whether or not that theory holds any water and why. What would have happened to any of us had we carried a loaded gun for the second time through an airport check system? We'll talk about that in a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup that explains the presence of Seema Iyer from WJZY, Queen City News. She's the chief legal correspondent there. Nick Oxner is the chief investigative reporter for WBTV. Joe Bruno is Twitter in chief at and reporter at WSOC-TV. And Jonathan Lowe is a reporter anchor for Spectrum News One. So I just heard from Madison Cawthorn. The comment that he posted on Instagram was directly in response to this pump and dump allegation of insider trading, saying essentially that people are poisoning the well against him. Is that true? Because there are a lot of videos that are coming out now that I would think he would not necessarily want out. Among them, one that came out last night that I don't even know how to explain. Another social media platform, is he being set up?
I don't know if he's being set up. I do think that there are a lot of targeted leaks, and I don't think it's particularly surprising when you have so many people endorsing his opponents that may have backed him in the past.
I mean, isn't this just good politics? For the opposite side, you know, this is what you're supposed to do.
Well, I guess the question is it the opposite side? Are people targeting within your own party the opposite side?
Yes. When you change districts to elbow out the Speaker of the House, who's a Republican, who drew a district for himself to run for Congress, you tend to start making enemies that way. When you defame your fellow Republicans in Congress with allegations of hookers and blow, literally, that's you start to make all of your fellow Republicans the opposite side. Yeah. So is this a smear campaign? Hard to say that with a straight face because they're all facts.
So very quickly, if you or I, Seema, or anybody on this panel or anybody listening had been caught for the second time with a loaded gun trying to go through the airport security at any airport in the country, what would have happened to us?
So it's a civil fine. It does not look, from at least what I looked at, any criminal penalties. But if it's unloaded, it's 2,000. And if it's loaded, it's 4,000. Of course, if you do it repeatedly, those penalties can increase.
So did he pay the penalty? Was he fined?
I don't know that. All I know is that he got a misdemeanor.
Okay. And finally, would I be correct in saying that Tom Tillis, who is now accusing or is calling for an ethics investigation into Madison Cawthorn for this insider trading, that Tom Tillis said nothing about the insider trading allegations levied against the senior senator from North Carolina, Richard Burr, several months ago?
He said something. It was okay. He said that Senator Burr owed an explanation.
Okay.
He wasn't as hard on Burr as he was Cawthorn, though.
Okay. And finally, there was the last debate before the primary among GOP candidates for North Carolina's Senate seat. Former Governor Pat McCrory and U.S. Representative Mark Walker showed up. Representative Ted Budd, the Trump pick, did not. But Mayor Pat went after Budd for that and other aspects of his record.
He's avoiding these debates. He's avoiding his record on voting against Trump's wall.
And we'll leave it at that. We all got a surprise this week when it was announced that McCray Dowless had died at the age of 66, very suddenly, from lung cancer. He's the political operative from Bladen County at the center of the election fraud scandal in the 9th Congressional District several years ago between Democrat Dan McCready and the man that Dowless was working for, Republican Mark Harris. That had yet to go to trial, I think, Nick, because of COVID delays. You knew and you spoke with McCray Dowless many, many times. You wrote a book about all of this. Did you know that he was that seriously ill?
Yes, yes. And he, if you recall, he had federal charges that he'd pleaded guilty to last year, and he was originally supposed to have reported to federal prison last December. That report date was pushed back to this month because his lawyer said he had just been diagnosed with lung cancer and was in the process of addressing his treatment plan. Then he was in hospice care for most of this month. I had a chance to go talk with him the Wednesday before Easter. So, you know, less than 2 weeks before he died. So it was somewhat of a quick quick diagnosis, but yes, he had been in declining health for several months.
So I may have the timeline wrong, but if I'm right, I think you reported on WBTV that this is likely the final chapter to this 2018 scandal, that he was never tried on his state election fraud charges, and said you'd be shocked if his co-defendant cases moved forward. But Wake County District Attorney Lauren Freeman is moving forward with the six others charged. So you're shocked. Should you be?
I'll still be shocked if they actually go to a trial. I know what Lauren Freeman has said this week. She also, in her statement, said that she was moving forward with the cases, keeping in mind that McCray Dowless was the operative at the center of these criminal schemes. I think that statement was couched in such a way that gives her some flexibility moving forward. Again, I've seen the 50,000 pages of criminal discovery that Lauren Freeman has against McCray and provided to McCray. There is no smoking gun there. As we know, she was planning to have, I think she told Joe again this week, planning to have cooperating witnesses testify against McCray Dowless. Here's the problem with that. All of those folks are convicted criminals. And as McCray once told me, everyone in Bladen County is a liar. You can't believe anybody, which I will second.
So I was, my next question was going to be the fact that McCray Dowless, till the bitter end, proclaimed his innocence in this. And in her statement, Lauren Freeman, the district attorney in Wake County, said Mr. Dowless was entitled to the presumption of innocence through his day in court. So from all of your investigations, your conversations with McCray Dowless, was he innocent, or can you not answer that question?
What I will say is I have not ever seen, and this is going to startle, and it's a hard truth for people to swallow who just have read the surface headlines and think they know. I have never seen hard evidence that he collected a ballot. Now, that might be because of poor and shoddy investigation by the SBI and FBI that didn't gather that evidence, but there was no hard evidence that I've ever seen that he was doing that. And moreover, we know there's evidence that he wasn't doing things like destroying ballots. Former state elections director Kim Strack said as much, has said as much publicly, who investigated the 2018. The unfortunate thing is, because Loren Freeman didn't schedule a trial before COVID, remember, he was under indictment more than a year before the court system shut down and then let this languish all the way through COVID. He never had a trial, and we'll see if anyone goes on trial to get the truth out.
So that means there will be no sequel to the book, The Vote Collectors. Buy it now so you'll have a foothold on what's going to happen in the movie. Is that right? Okay.
Knock on wood movie. Agents, my phone is standing by.
Another death of note that we should mention, Jill Swain, the former Huntersville mayor, has passed away this week at the age of 61. She was also the founder and executive director of the Huntersville Chamber of Commerce. She was a commissioner there for 8 years and mayor for 8 years. So our condolences to her family. The back and forth over the Panthers practice facility and headquarters in Rock Hill has been replete with excuses and promises, mostly from York County and Rock Hill and South Carolina officials. Panther owner David Tepper has been mum until this week at his first press conference in more than a year. But this is all he had to say about that $800 million facility.
You know, we're just right now trying to just get together to talk and make those arrangements. And that's all I'm going to say on the matter. I'm just going to respect their request not to play this out at all. Okay, I'm sorry.
He referred to the statement the organization released when they terminated the deal, and remind us, if you would, what that statement said about the termination of the deal.
The line that stuck out to me was there was a disinformation campaign essentially against the Panthers, and they tried to sour the Panthers through the court of public opinion. But they are terminating the agreements with Rock Hill. They're willing to meet with them to discuss the long and complicated road ahead.
Could that be why he doesn't want to talk right now? Because if there are going to be further conversations, he doesn't want to mess them up.
It's probably in his legal interest to be quiet at this point.
But he did take the time to assure the people of Rock Hill that no matter what happens, the Panthers organization will be there. He said, quote, supporting the community in different fashions, in charity, and I think we'll probably be in York County for Keep Pounding Day. Clearly burning no bridges there, and that leads us to what he had to say about the Panthers and Charlotte FC's current home, Bank of America Stadium, which is the oldest stadium in the NFL. He talked about a feasibility study now underway to determine the cost of continuing to use that facility.
I've said often that this is the best place for the Panthers uptown, you know, where the stadium is right now. It is the center of two states. We are the Carolina Panthers.
Ah, yes. But could he, would he, might he, dare he move?
After being here and seeing how gorgeous it is here and how nice it is to come to the stadium and just sit under the sun and enjoy it and just like, frick. I mean, it's just nice. Why would you ever want to do something different?
I want to point out he had a smile on his face. He was enjoying the image that he was creating. Maybe he means this. Can we all breathe easily now, or should we just wait for the ask?
I don't get the impression. It was a question that had to be asked, but I don't get the impression that he's looking to move the team out of Charlotte. Where would he take it to, first of all? I think we do have to wait for the ask and see what the ask is with it. If it will be renovations to Bank of America Stadium, I know the Observer has some reporting out on that, or if he will ask for a new stadium. That question that answer we just played was about a question about dome, whether he still wants a dome for whatever is to come. And it sounds like the answer is no, because of how beautiful North Carolina is in the fall.
He also used that press conference to not comment on the Panthers' pursuit of quarterback Deshaun Watson, and he also had no comment on what quarterbacks he was liking in the first round of the NFL draft, which took place last night. But he did call Sam Darnold a very good quarterback with incredible skills. And he underlined the fact that head coach Matt Rhule has his full support, but that we need patience to build the foundation. Is he talking about 5 or 6 years here? Would that be right?
His contract's 5 years, but it might take 6, he also said.
And he reminded everybody that Rome wasn't built in a day, but Rome was built 3,000 years ago, and people had more patience, and the news cycle was much longer. So I'm wondering if that's a good analogy. I want to share with you, however, a description of what of the Panthers' decision in the first round of the NFL draft that was written in the New York Times this morning. It says, the Carolina Panthers selected North Carolina State tackle Ikem Ekwonu. Is that how you say his name? At the number 6 position, the number 6 draft pick. A surprising decision, they write, because the Panthers were expected to select a quarterback to replace Cam Newton, who proved to be a poor replacement for Sam Darnold, who was a poor replacement for Teddy Bridgewater, who was a poor replacement for Cam Newton. That pretty much sums it up, doesn't it?
Well, you know, the quarterback that people want the Panthers to draft is still on the board. He didn't go in the first round, Malik Willis. So maybe the Panthers will get the last laugh. They'll get a star tackle who they drafted last night, and they'll end up getting the potential successor to Sam Darnold.
At the risk of turning this into a round the horn, this was not a particularly impressive draft class for quarterbacks. It was heavy on wide receivers and defensive players last night. So, yes, I think it's fair to say the Panthers are looking for value in the second round. They might still get their franchise quarterback. We'll have to wait and see.
Okay. That's what I'm talking about. The news cycle is just too fast to keep up with it. Swastikas, the symbol of the German Nazi Party and now something that's been co-opted by white nationalists in this country, were found in residence halls this week at Queen's University. Seema, reaction from the administration and others was swift. What did they say?
Well, they said that this is absolutely unacceptable, that they are going to beef up security measures. They spoke to one of our reporters. I just want to point out, and because I covered the white supremacy trial in Charlottesville, Virginia, which is actually part of our federal district, the Fourth Circuit. And in my experience, a lot of the problem is people don't seem to take anti-Semitism as seriously as other forms of racism. So I hope that changes. I hope this case has now enlightened people in this area.
Well, I know that they've gotten law enforcement involved in the investigation into whom might have put these swastikas up. What could happen? I mean, if those responsible are found, law enforcement is involved. Is this a crime?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they could argue, even though it doesn't rise to the level of a hate crime, perhaps, and that gets a little tricky in terms of federal versus state, but the bare minimum is that it could be a trespass, it could be defaming property. You know, just even just property crimes could at least get them to prosecute either on a misdemeanor or felony level, for sure.
And do they have any idea yet who might have done this?
We have not heard yet.
Very quickly, because I have 30 seconds, there was a nursing shortage prior to the pandemic. The pandemic made it worse, and now North Carolina healthcare systems are struggling to recruit nurses. Queen City News reports that the research company Mercer predicts North Carolina will be one of the worst states for nursing shortages by 2024. Why?
Okay, so number one, obvious, the pandemic. People have run out of the profession. But number two, which is more interesting, is that a bulk of nurses are baby boomers and they're just retiring. But I just want to alert everyone, on May 12th, a group of nurses and some from this area are going to ask Congress to pass federal laws to protect nurses. This is called the National Nurses March. It's going to be in D.C. and it should help change this around in North Carolina.
And it was Seema Iyer who got the last word. For those of you who are placing bets at the start of the show, she's with WJCY Queen City News. Joe Bruno here from WSOC-TV, Nick Oxner from WBTV, and Jonathan Lowe from Spectrum News One. Thank you all for the hour. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.